Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. A century and a quarter ago, a social movement was born in this country, modeled on an effort to help the poor in London. A woman by the name of Jane Addams, the first American woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize, by the way, established this country's first settlement house, Hull House, in Chicago. In succeeding years, settlement houses, today often called neighborhood houses, began to spring up around the country. Their mission was to provide and administer a wide range of services to the needy, including social welfare, health, education, and other services. As government began playing a larger role in providing and funding these and other services, the number of settlement houses and neighborhood houses decreased. Many are still with us, however. In fact, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the social services agency Neighborhood Houses, which started as a settlement house here in 1913. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, we'll be talking about settlement houses, past, present, and future. A little later in the program, we'll talk about what's going on locally. But we'll begin with author Louise Knight. She has written extensively about Jane Addams. Her books are titled Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy, and Jane Addams, Spirit in Action. She joins us by phone from Evanston, Illinois. Louise, it's very nice to be with you. And I'd like to ask you to start, if you would, with give us kind of an early history of the whole settlement house thing and why it's important.
Well, it began as an idea in London by a minister of the Anglican Church who was practicing in the East End, which is a very low-income, working-class neighborhood in London in the 1880s, and he couldn't get anyone to show up to church. And so he started trying to figure out what they would be drawn to and realized that a community center would be a good idea, a place to go and relax and gain some knowledge of the world and culture. At the same time, he was a graduate of Oxford, and he had friends, young men who were working in the city, recent graduates of Oxford and Cambridge, who felt very depressed that they were sort of ignorant of the working class world and not able to connect to it at all, and they were curious about his life in the East End. So he put all that together, and the resulting concept was a settlement house. And the term refers to the idea that these college graduates from Oxford and Cambridge would settle, that is, go to live in a working-class neighborhood where they wouldn't normally live, and they would interact with all their new neighbors and share, there was a noblesse oblige aspect, share their cultural knowledge, their knowledge of history and literature, et cetera, with working class people, but there was also supposed to be an exchange where they learned about working class lives and tried to do what they could to improve society's laws to make their lives better.
What about services? Were they totally focused on changing laws, or were there services also provided?
Well, it's interesting. Services was not the focus. It is, of course, the modern focus, but originally it was much more just a neighborly relationship. So they had clubs, they had classes, they had billiard tables for boys and men to play billiards with, you know, the residents at the settlement house. It was all supposed to be enriching. When they worked on the laws, it was because of their partnerships with labor unions and their education about what was going on with the local school boards and things like that. But there were no services per se. Now, there were people who would come to the settlement and say, I can't pay my rent, I'm about to go under, and then they would scramble around to try and help them. Eventually, Toynbee Hall, which was the name of this London settlement, did offer what we would call services like a daycare program or kindergarten. They did have a housing bureau later on. They had a jobs bureau later on. But those all evolved because there were needs. It wasn't part of the original vision.
And where does Jane Addams come into the picture?
Jane Addams visited Toynbee Hall when she was in Europe in 1887, and it just was exactly what she was looking for. She already knew she wanted to live in a working-class neighborhood and, quote, help the poor, but she had no idea how to go about it. And so after visiting, she knew she wanted to start a settlement house. Being an American, she knew she wanted to settle in a neighborhood in Chicago that had a lot of immigrants. That was a difference from her vision in Toynbee Halls. They didn't have the kind of immigrants from outside Great Britain that the United States did. So that was a big difference. She also wanted a co-ed settlement, which was both co-ed in terms of residents and co-ed in terms of other volunteers from around the city who helped offer the programs and classes and activities. And that was different, too. Toynbee Hall was all men and was restricted to only men, and they didn't admit women for decades. So I would say Hull House was a little bit more cutting edge in those respects.
And what were the immediate challenges that she faced?
Well, the first challenge was to raise money to finance it. She herself was born to wealth, but she wasn't mega rich, but she had a comfortable income from her inheritance. Her father died when she was in her early 20s. So she financed half the operating cost of the settlement house in its first year and continued to help underwrite it for a while. But she did eventually attract many, many donors that supported the house. No government money, all private dollars. But her other big challenge was obviously building trust with the people in the neighborhood, many of whom thought, what in the world are two, because she did this with a friend, Ellen Gates Starr, what are two prosperous, well-dressed women doing living here? Here being the near west side, Halsted Street, a heavily industrial district crowded with tenements where the workers lived, and, you know, an unhealthy, garbage-strewn place because the city didn't pick up the garbage often enough. So it took a while for them to get relationships going, and they went out and they had many conversations with people on the streets. They invited them to visit them. They had a rather nice house in the middle of this ugly neighborhood, and then the neighbors gradually invited them to visit them in their communities, in their housing. And the trust had to overcome the class gap, of course, and so that took a long time. And in the immediate, you know, present, there were little boys throwing stones at their windows. But the children were drawn to the clubs and activities there because they had nothing to do when they weren't working. And so that was a great way of overcoming resistance in the neighborhood because the children would tell their parents, and the parents would be excited about what the children were enjoying at the settlement house.
How long did it take to establish a full measure of trust in the neighborhood?
Well, that's a good question. I can only guess, but I would say probably 3 years. They made some mistakes, and they alienated people because of their mistakes. They didn't understand how they'll look to the working class people in their neighborhood. For example, they try when a person died and no family claimed the body, they set up a for the Cook County funeral people to come take the body away, and the women of the neighborhood were upset and said, "You can't, that's no way to dignified way to bury a person. You have to have a proper funeral with horses and a carriage. We'll help raise the money." So they learned. And they learned how committed the people in the neighborhood were to helping each other in times of distress. They came to respect the people in the neighborhood as extremely generous and hardworking for the most part, which were not ideas they had in their minds when they came to the Settlement House neighborhood. So I'd say it took about 3 years to really get a good education, and they continued to make errors along the way after that, of course.
Such as?
Well, they were, I'll give an example. There was a theory among settlement reformers and others that the best way to have a healthy diet was to eat boiled New England food, potatoes and meat and all those things that New Englanders like to eat. And the theory was if you boiled it in a big tub with a lid for 3 hours, that the food you then ate from the tub, which would obviously be very thoroughly cooked, would be more nutritious. They didn't understand the nutrition was all leaching out into the water, which, of course, they threw away. So they tried to set up a diet kitchen at Hull House that served this diet to the people, and the people said, "Yeah, I don't want to eat that." So it was kind of a flop because, of course, the people wanted to eat their own native foods in their own native ways. And so that was an error they made.
What about its evolution as time begins to move along for us here? How did it change over the years? Hull House only closed relatively recently, did it not?
Yes, it closed about a year ago due to too large a budget deficit to keep on going. What happened to Hull House was after it stayed more or less the same. Obviously, it increased in programs and classes and numbers of residents. It ended up having, I think, at least 80 residents, and it had 13 buildings filling a city block, and it was quite a huge operation and worldwide famous. But after Adams died, things changed quite a bit. For one thing, they started taking what we now call United Way money, which meant that United Way had some input into programs, which Adams would never have accepted. And then soon after, when government money started becoming available after World War II, it began to take a lot of government contracts delivering services, and that became its very predominant role up to its demise. On the other hand, part of its demise was due to the fact that government funding kept cutting back, and the settlement was not adjusting itself fully to the loss of income. I would also say that what settlement houses have become, which is extremely crucial, which is an arm of the government in delivering needed services, is quite different from the original vision, which was much more egalitarian, much more class bridging, much more social. So, I don't know if that aspect can be restored as long as settlement houses and neighborhood centers are focused on getting their funds from government contracts, but it is one of the interesting historical differences.
Over during the earlier years, going back to those years, it's my understanding that they kind of went back to what the British were doing early on, and that is looking at changes in laws, particularly child labor laws and that sort of thing. How much of an impact did Jane Addams have there?
Well, yeah, actually the early history of the early settlement leaders, including Adams, was increasingly focused by the late 1890s on legislative change. First in the states, Jane Addams and others, Florence Kelly especially, led a campaign to change the Illinois law so that child labor was illegal, and setting in place a minimum hour requirement for women of 8 hours, which was later knocked down by the Illinois Supreme Court, unfortunately. But both of those issues, 8-hour day, end of child labor, became national issues pushed hard by the settlement house movement leaders in the early 20th century. They didn't become law until the 1930s, but they were causes. The child labor law became law several times, but it kept getting knocked down by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the settlement house movement was an amazing force for social reform, progressive reform in the early 20th century. Another example is the whole issue around public housing. They started working on that in 1900, at first in their own cities and later nationally. And they were working on all sorts of issues that we still are working on today. There's a wonderful book, Spearheads of Reform, by Alan Davis. An old book, but a very good book, that traces all this rich history and all the different ways they were changing the face of the city. They're also leaders in the public parks movement and playground movement. They were leaders in immigrant reform. They were opposed to the immigrant restriction laws that got put in place in the 20s. They supported women's suffrage to some extent, at least the women's settlement houses did. They supported labor union mediation rights, the right to strike. They supported women organizing when the AFL didn't want to do it. They were right up there on the cutting edge.
Yeah, it sounds like it was pretty much a hotbed of liberalism during the early days.
Well, I should clarify. I'm speaking of mostly the early settlement house leaders and their settlements. There were many settlement houses all around the country that did not particularly get engaged in the politics. And that was the bulk of the houses. It was the houses in Chicago, New York, Boston in particular, that were generating this kind of reform energy. Many settlement houses were focused on their neighborhoods and focused on providing, meeting the needs of their neighbors, enriching the lives of their neighbors. And some of them were religiously inspired. The earliest ones were not. They were what we might call secular. They intentionally did not want to introduce the subject of religion in any of their relationships, and that was because they were aware that they were in diverse immigrant communities that had diverse religious organizations, and there were many religions among their neighbors. On the other hand, right from the beginning, there were settlement houses that were inspired by a desire to bring Christianity or some form of Christianity into the immigrant neighborhoods, and those flourished as well. When the National Federation of Settlement Houses was founded in 1911, however, they did not admit to their membership the religious settlements, and that was obviously because there was a difference in philosophy there. Eventually they did, but it took a long while. So there were some points of tension because obviously the secular houses thought it important not to have a religious aspect to them, whereas the religious houses deeply believed they needed to be doing that.
I have to take a break, but I'd like to give you one more question before we let you go, Louise Knight. And that is, there are a number of people, I would have to say, on the right end of the political spectrum today who would like to see government get out of the area of helping people in need and have organizations like Settlement Houses, used to be anyway, and to a large degree probably still are, have them handle the needs of the poor. Will we ever get there?
Gosh, I couldn't say as to whether we will get there. I do think that it was a strength of the early settlement houses to have so much private support, that is to say not to have government support, because it gave them so much programming flexibility. They could do what they wanted to do. And the problem with government funds, even though it's ostensibly more reliable and certainly, you know, funds needed services, is that the settlement house itself or the neighborhood center is sort of locked into providing those particular services or persuading the government to fund a different one that they aren't funding now. So I don't know what will actually happen, but I think that both funding models have their advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, government money always comes with strings attached. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Louise Knight, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us today and giving us your insight and expertise on the history of the settlement houses. We're going to take it locally once we come back from this next break. But again, I'm appreciative of your being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And thank you for being interested in settlement houses. That's terrific.
Well, they play an important role, always have, and will continue to do so, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll take this subject local. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. We're going to move on now to the modern era of settlement houses. We're joined in studio by Darlene Soule, President and CEO of the organization Neighborhood Houses. Jessica Brandon is Executive Director of the Guardian Angels Settlement Association and President of the St. Louis Federation of Settlement Houses and Neighborhood Centers. Joining us by phone is Bill Krieb, President and CEO of the Lessie Bates Davis Neighborhood House in East St. Louis. I thank you all for being with us. Bill, just want to make sure you're there. Are you?
I'm here.
Okay, well, thanks for being with us, and you are listening to the first segment of this program, I'm
sure.
I was. Yeah. Let me ask each of you, and Darlene, I'll begin with you, if you can give me kind of a thumbnail sketch of your organization and its evolution.
Sure, Don. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. Neighborhood Houses is celebrating its centennial this year. We were founded in 1913, and our first location was called Caroline Mission. And just as Louise talked about, it was founded by a group of individuals, particularly seminarians from Eden Seminary, who thought there was a need with young immigrants in the Lafayette Square area. And so we located at Hickory Street and Dillon and were providing services for that population and living in that population.
What kind of services initially?
Initially, primarily child care, help with housing and housing needs, also providing emergency services, food, clothing, and some religious services as well.
And over the years, how many people have been serviced by?
Oh, gosh, I wish I knew. But, that is the magical number. It's probably been tens of thousands
tens
of individuals.
Tens of thousands, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Jessica, let me turn to you. Same thing for your organizations, if you will.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me today. Guardian Angel was originally founded in 1859 as an orphanage, and it was founded by the Daughters of Charity. And it wasn't until 1911 that they sort of transformed themselves into a settlement house. And over time, programs and services have changed. Like with all settlement houses, our idea is that we're providing the programs and services that are most needed by the community. So the community has guided that programming. Currently, we're providing services in two areas. One is early childhood education. So we're providing Head Start and early Head Start for 160 kids in the city of St. Louis. And then we also have a social services department. And through that department, we provide case management services, a food pantry, a thrift store, and rent utility assistance to help people stay in their homes.
And what about the Federation, the other hat you wear?
Yes. The St. Louis Federation of Settlement Houses was formed in 2010, and it is a group of eight settlement house agencies, providing services all across the city. And the Federation was founded with the idea that all of us banding together to provide comprehensive services across the city, we could accomplish more working together than either any of the eight of us could individually.
So are you two affiliated, Darlene? Are you affiliated
yes.
with the Federation?
Neighborhood Houses is part of the Federation.
Okay.
As is Bill.
Yeah. Okay, Bill, it's your turn. Give me that thumbnail sketch of your organization, please.
Okay. Yeah, the Leslie Bates Davis Neighborhood House, we were founded in 1909 by the United Methodist Church, actually a group of called the Women's Home Missionary Society. There were a large population of Bohemic and Slavonic people who kind of got stuck over in the east side, and there were about 1,000 little shanty shacks, you know, all around. Seeing this suffering, this group of women decided they needed to start a ministry. So they brought over this minister, Reverend Francais, who began ministering to them in the back of an old saloon, and that's kind of how the Neighborhood House started. Over the years, the programs grew, and a lady named Miss Davis, whose husband was a doctor in the St. Louis area, raised about $125,000 to build a new building in 1940, and so that's how we ended up getting our name. We were originally called the St. Louis Settlement House. And so today we're a multi-purpose community center. We have about 230 staff, about 300 volunteers. We operate about 15 different programs, serving kids from 6 weeks to seniors 96 years of age. We have daycare, and we run the Migrant Head Start program also. We have a food pantry. We serve about 5,000 people every month in our food pantry, a homeless street ministry, an in-home health care program, a youth services program, a homeless youth program. So it's just a comprehensive array of services that are trying to meet, you know, the needs of the entire family. Our mission really is to help families move out of poverty, individuals and families move out of poverty, because what we see is all the kinds of services that we provide, really we're treating symptoms of the problem. And so what we feel is we need to really help them get jobs and become self-sufficient.
Is there a religious affiliation?
Yeah, as I said, we're a United Methodist.
Oh, I'm sorry. I must have missed that. What about funding, Bill?
Our funding, as you heard from your guest, most settlement houses, you know, were started back in the early times because there really weren't any government or federal programs. And so really, I believe the church really stepped up to minister to the poor. And back, for example, in 1913, there were more than 430 settlement houses in about 32 states. And actually, the majority of those were faith-based organizations, started by faith-based organizations. And so today, our funding, however, has become, you know, predominantly state and federal funding. However, we do receive a large portion of our funds from the United Way, which enables us really to do a lot of special things that we couldn't do with other funding from the state. But I guess I would disagree with your guess that the federal and state money kind of limit us in a lot of ways. You know, we feel that, you know, we're able to utilize those funds to meet the special needs of the people in our community. And I would say, Darlene, and everybody else would agree that, you know, what we're doing is meeting a need, and so that's what's important.
Doyle, Darlene, what do you think?
I agree with Bill. We are also a United Way agency, but founded by the United Church of Christ through Eden Seminary. Mm-hmm. But those additional funds, along with other major funders in the city, the Mental Health Board and Arches, have allowed us to really streamline the work that we do. So at Neighborhood Houses, we have chosen to focus on our three core competencies, which are early childhood education, after-school programs. We are now the largest no-cost provider of after-schools in the city. We can serve 900 children a day. And then an Teen Moms program. So trying to take a comprehensive view of how to engage the whole family over 12 or 13 years. But we have the capacity to serve 1,000 children and youth a day, but we also need that additional financial assistance.
Same story for you, Jessica?
Absolutely. The needs of the community are just so great that it has become necessary to pursue any and all funding possibilities. And state and federal funds are an important part of that. But the support of the United Way is also incredibly important. And the support of donors who are living in the community, you know, individual folks who recognize the needs of the community and want to make a difference, they're the ones that are really helping us get all the good work done that we are.
And yet it seems that Hull House up in Chicago, that its demise was accelerated by accepting government funds.
Or not.
Well, that was only part of it, actually. There were other issues in relation to, delays in receiving funds. As you know, Illinois has some, very challenging financial crisis right now, and so for example, the state owes us more than $1.5 million right now, but they didn't close because they were accepting funds. They closed because these funds weren't coming in a timely manner. But the reality is that non-for-profits have clearly demonstrated that they're able to provide services to the people, whether it's Head Start services or healthcare, much more efficiently and effectively. And so that's why we have so many non-for-profits, not just settlement houses, but other non-for-profits doing that kind of work. And, in the St. Louis area, the people in the St. Louis area are probably the most generous people in the United States. And I think that's evidenced by how much they give to United Way and so many other organizations. And we believe we really use those funds to the best of our ability to make sure the needs in the community are being met.
We've heard discussion as part of this program about community guidelines, having the community set various guidelines for how your institutions work. How does that work? I'll start with you, Darlene. How does the community establish guidelines?
Well, I would say they establish guidelines by letting us know what the needs are. Particularly, if I focus on the after-school program, one of the things that we have seen which has caused us to change the way we do business and serve the community is our children over the years used to walk to school, and they'd come to our centers for support. Kids don't walk to school anymore. And so we have had to adjust how we do our programming, and so now my staff go to the schools. They're already in a safe environment, and so we're doing our services that way. So that's an external change that has dictated how we augment our services and how we're, plan to be around for, several more decades.
And Jessica, how are guidelines established with you?
Our neighbors are involved because we ask them to be involved on an ongoing basis. In the fall of last year, we undertook a large community needs assessment process to make sure that the services we were providing were the most needed. And the results of that needs assessment have helped guide programming for this year and will many years into the future. What was identified first and foremost was the significant problem of hunger in our community. And because of that, we have reallocated some resources to our food pantry to make sure that we can meet those increasing needs.
Mm-hmm. And Bill will put the same to you, how the guidelines are established and what
our guidelines were. Certainly through our efforts to do community needs assessment, but, in working with our existing families and, the individuals in the community, we have a group called the 100 Black Men who, came to us. We were looking at providing some types of services, but it ended up, after our meetings saying, what they really needed was more help in looking to help to get jobs, going back to school to get additional training, and then getting those job readiness skills. And so we may have made some changes in our programming just in the past year to try to reflect those additional needs or new needs that they have identified. So this is an ongoing process that we have. For example, another big program is that there's thousands of young women in the St. Louis region who have lost all their income because of the way that the federal welfare program now works. You can only be on it for 5 years. And so many of these persons have already completed their 5 years, so these children and families are out there with nothing, and as Jessica said, we've also stepped up our level of our work with our food pantry and other emergency services programs.
I'm interested in the religious overtone to all of your organizations. What role does that play? And I hate to use the word, but is it an opportunity to proselytize, to seek people to join your particular group?
Well, neighborhood houses, it has taken on a different form. And as the author mentioned earlier, accepting of governmental funds make it necessary for us to be careful. But we can talk to our young people about character education, and that is a part of addressing the needs of the whole child. So that is a part of our curriculum and the daily interaction we have with children in all of our programs to make sure we talk about how to care for each other, how to care for your neighbor.
Jessica, you know, go ahead, Bill.
Well, for us, you know, a key part of the United Methodist mission, as well as both the United Church of Christ and you know, Catholics and all the other denominations, each denomination has a very strong social justice piece that they're involved in. So for us, it's a tremendous benefit because we're able to get the people in our churches throughout the state of Illinois to, you know, become child advocates and speak up against some of the injustices, you know, that exist, you know, for the fact that one out of every five children in Illinois is living in poverty. You know, when we're able to get our churches to say, hey, as Christians, we have to respond to this. And I think it's really consistent with the whole concept of settlement houses where, you know, we weren't just, you know, a health care agency or a youth service agency, but we're agencies that are kind of developed to take risks and to make sacrifices. And so I think the people who are in the churches, not necessarily in our own, both in our own community and outside our community, are seeing that opportunity, and they're joining with us to try to address some of those justice issues.
Jessica, do you want to weigh in on this part of it?
Absolutely. Again, Guardian Angel was founded by the Daughters of Charity as the first Catholic settlement house in the United States. And although we're not providing overtly religious programming now, we carry on that tradition of service to the community and working with our community partners.
Mm-hmm. I have to take a break right now. We'll continue our conversation. We're talking about settlement houses, past, present, and future. Some of them are called neighborhood houses now. And my guests in studio are Darlene Soule, President and CEO of Neighborhood Houses here in St. Louis. Jessica Brannon is Executive Director of the Guardian Angel Settlement Association and President of the St. Louis Federation of Settlement Houses and Neighborhood Centers. And Bill Kreeb is joining us by phone. He's President and CEO of the Leslie Bates Davis Neighborhood House. Back to continue our conversation, and we'd like to get you in on it. What are your own experiences with neighborhood houses or settlement houses? We'd love to hear from you. And what would you like to see the role of neighborhood houses to be? 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on settlement houses. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. At this hour, opponents of the recent George Zimmerman verdict in Sanford, Florida, are rallying outside the old courthouse downtown. And Missouri Governor Jane Nixon is in St. Louis talking to members of the St. Louis Regional Chamber. These stories and more beginning at 3 on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on our website, stlpublicradio.org. Ladies, I'll ask you, when did the emphasis change from settlement houses to neighborhood houses? Apparently, at some point, one overtook the other. Do we know that?
Don, I don't know the details of that. I think it was probably an evolution of just the way that the services were provided, and perhaps with a moving away of some of the organizations and their religious background. But just to add one thing about our religious founding, and I'm sure both of my peers would echo, without the volunteerism and the support of the religious organizations that started us, and for neighborhood houses as United Church of Christ and Disciples of Christ, we wouldn't have been around for the century that we have been. The interaction and the work and the volunteer efforts of those parishioners is priceless to us.
Are any settlement houses, you just agreed obviously, Jessica, with that. Are any of the settlement houses non-religious affiliated? Do you know? I mean, or do all of them typically have some sort of religious affiliation?
In the St. Louis area, within our federation, I believe Youth and Family Center was not founded as from a religious church. But the rest of us?
Pretty much that's mm-hmm. the way it is. You know, I'm interested, before I go to the phones, we're getting some calls, and I'll take them right away. I'm interested in what is going on today and the economy that we have had and the difficulties with the governments of state, has been pointed out by Louise earlier, and we're all well aware of it. There just isn't the money out there that there used to be. And I'll start with you, Jessica. How much of an impact is that having on what you do and what you're doing?
Absolutely. Funding and finding funding is a constant struggle for all of the 8 agencies in the Federation and many other agencies, of course, as
sure.
well.
Yeah.
And that was really a big part of why the Federation came together, the idea that we could talk about impact on a broader scale instead of each of our individual 8 agencies, and really look at how we could best use the resources that are available in the community to serve the people who need access to services. So the idea is that by working together, we can create some economies of scale, that we can share resources amongst each other. And so that's really what the Federation is all about, trying to use limited resources in the best way that we can.
And Darlene, of course, the need is ever greater now, too, for the same reason.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Bill, I guess you're going to pretty much echo what Jessica just said.
Sure. I mean, we've seen a 30% increase in the demand for services just in the past 5 years, and especially since the downturn in the economy back in 2008. And so many of our people, the population has somewhat changed. It's not just, you know, the very low income or low income. There's a lot of working poor people who are now coming to us, especially for our homeless programs. You know, people who just lost their job last year, their unemployment ran out, and now they need some help. And, you know, our goal is to try to help them, you know, both with that emergency assistance, but then we try to refer out to other agencies that maybe are able to even do more from an employment standpoint. So, you know, the economy is certainly, you know, starting to rebound, I think, and we were able to help people with a few more jobs, but we still have a long way to go.
But, you know, there's talk in Washington, and it's probably not going to happen, but they're talking in conjunction with this new farm bill of eliminating food stamps, for instance. What happens to organizations like yours if, in fact, that ever came to pass? Darlene, you have an expression that tells me a lot.
Well, it would be devastating. I mean, I think about our early child education program, and probably 90% of those families are on some type of child care subsidy. And so you are directly keeping those families from their ability to thrive and make sure that their children are receiving the nutrition they need so that they can learn and be able to become productive citizens. So you, by doing that, you create a permanent underclass and limit the opportunity for people to, you know, achieve the American dream.
I would think it would be overwhelming, Jessica, for organizations like yours if something like that were to happen.
Absolutely. We are already seeing, you know, thousands and thousands of people in our food pantry, and that's with the food stamp yeah. program in existence as it currently is. I mean, the demand for our services would go up exponentially.
And Bill, obviously the same for you.
Yeah, certainly the same for us. You know, I'd just like to go back to one question you had done before.
Yeah.
This was about our affiliation with our churches. You know, I think in many ways our settlement houses today are really not that much different than the old settlement houses. You know, where we are, people would come and live for a year or two and work. You know, who had the resources to do that. But today, as Darlene said, we get hundreds of volunteers in all the time, and they see this as an opportunity, just like the people back in the early 1900s, to come down, you know, work with people who they see as their brothers and sisters, and try to help us out. And so, you know, whether it's building homes through Habitat or building or fixing up our own buildings, repairing the bathrooms or the gyms or whatever, I mean, they do this on a regular basis. Plus, you know, they're on the soup buses, they're in the food pantries, they're a lot of our volunteers who are from our churches are really carrying out their ministry and their commitment to mission, you know, through these settlement houses, both in the St. Louis area as well as throughout the United States.
Are they basically younger or older, or is it just a mix?
It's a mix, yeah. From 90 to 10.
90 to 10. And that's, Jessica, that's the way it is. Okay, let's go to the phones. We have some calls. Let's get Lynn calling from Florence and into the conversation. Lynn, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is about going back to the lunch program when you were talking about assisting the children at schools with meals. I was wondering, do you help them fill out paperwork or direct them in the right direction as a programs that are already in place through the state or through the school districts, or how do you assist with the meal programs?
Who would like to take that, Darlene?
The meal programs within the schools?
Yes, you know how when my kids were in school, they get, at the beginning of the year, they get something offering them to fill it out to see if they need a help through the state as far as meal programs for breakfast and lunches, free breakfast, free lunches, or discounted breakfast and lunches.
All of the schools that Neighborhood Houses provides after-school programs, and are over 80% of the children in those 13 schools are already eligible for the federal food program. So that is an aspect of our service that we do not have to engage in. But where we do help is in the early childhood education program to make sure those families have met with their social workers so they can continue to get the extra support that they need.
Okay, great. So that's the early education program is where you come in to help.
Yes.
Okay. And so can you tell us, when you mentioned the social workers, if there's somebody out there that is actually needing help with going into a settlement house, can you give a phone number or what's the best way to contact somebody for that?
Probably the best way to contact the right agency, that's the agency that's serving your area, is by contacting the United Way's info line, and that can be accessed by dialing 211. And the United Way maintains a comprehensive database of all the resources that are available in the community, in the area where you are living, so you don't waste a lot of time calling agencies that may be zip code restricted or don't have the services that you need.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And rather than ask each of you the same question, I'm going to assume for the most part that you're all doing essentially the same thing. You might do it a little bit differently, but you're all providing the same kinds of services. Is that correct?
That's
it could
correct.
Be, yes. Yeah. And it could be different populations. And that's the beauty of the Federation. I do not serve the senior population, but many of my peers do. So if I have a family that comes with those needs, I can refer them.
Darlene, could we lift up the other members of our Federation?
Absolutely. Yeah. Three of the Federation partners are here today. But in addition to that, Kingdom House, Grace Hill Settlement House, the Youth and Family Center, Wesley House, and Beyond Housing are the other members of the Federation.
Our old friend Chris Kramer, who's been on this program a good many times, mm-hmm. and all of them do just wonderful work. Can't speak highly enough of those organizations. Back to the phones. Jeff has been waiting patiently. Jeff, thanks for doing so. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm curious to know, and I would have liked to ask your first guest, but and maybe these guests know, if Margaret Sanger had any connection with the Settlement House movement, and what relationship did the Catholic Worker movement have with the Settlement House movement, and are the Catholic Worker houses here in St. Louis part of the Federation?
Jessica,
I don't know about the first one, but I know the Catholic Workers houses around the, you know, some of the settlement houses and some of the actually the Catholic Workers houses were kind of modeled after one another, but I don't know if the Catholic Workers houses here, I don't think they're not a part of the Greater St. Louis Federation at this point.
Well, thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We have some lines open, folks, 382-8255. Come on in if you have questions. Jessica, you deal with specific zip codes, do you not?
We do.
Why is that, and how did that evolve?
Again, that, you know, came from the settlement house idea that it's impossible to serve every area of the city comprehensively. So our focus has been for many years on 63104, which is Soulard, and 63118, which is the area immediately to the south of Soulard. And again, the idea is our impact, our resources are limited, and so we don't want to spread those too thin. So we focused on those two areas, those two zip codes.
Bill, I'll start with you and ask the others as well, because this may differ from organization to organization. But how do people get to you? I mean, obviously we're talking neighborhoods, but what does someone do if they want to become involved somehow in terms of the services? What do they do?
Well, it depends on the services. We actually have five different sites in the greater East St. Louis area, in like Washington Park, East St. Louis, Allerton, Centerville, all over. A lot of it's word of mouth, you know, so people in our child care center who are already there, you know, they hear about the work we're doing, and they tell somebody else, and they come in, they walk in, and they fill out an application, and they're able to enroll. A lot of times with needing emergency assistance, again, as Jessica said, people will call the United Way, and then if it's over here on the east side, they'll often make a referral to our agency or one of the other agencies over here. And again, we have case managers and caseworkers, social workers who do crisis intervention and work with them as much as possible. And same with health care. For our seniors, we serve about 400 very low-income elderly persons. Those referrals actually come through the state of Illinois and through like a program called Visiting Nurses. So they come to us in a lot of different manners.
Do you ever reach out to them, Darlene? I mean, when you see someone, a child perhaps, or someone who looks to be in need, do you approach them?
Yes, we do. Actually, at Caroline Mission with the Early Childhood Education Center, we actually go out and actively recruit. So we will visit the WIC offices. We make contact with the unemployment offices in the area to make sure that those individuals know that child care is available for those families that are trying to work. We also reach out to the St. Louis Public Schools as well as hospitals, the maternity wards for our Teen Moms program. And in the after-school program, we do applications at the school when at the beginning of the school year.
As time begins to wind down, and I'll give this to each of you, starting with you, Jessica, what lies ahead? I mean, where are you pointing your direction right now? What are you thinking about next?
There are certainly limitless needs in the community, so our constant commitment is to really taking a good look at what is available in terms of resources and what is most needed in our community. So we plan to continue to be responsive to emerging community needs and really making the most of the partnership of the agencies that are in the Federation to be taking a holistic look at services in the city of St. Louis and really pooling our resources together to making the biggest difference we can.
Darlene?
Well, for me, I'm very focused right now with our centennial. So our big event is November 2nd at the Four Seasons, and it gives us an opportunity to relaunch because of the name recognition and the need to make sure everyone knows the services that we provide. And we have moved away from the place-based focus on services to experiences. So making sure the children and youth that we serve have experiences that allow them to see something different that they may not otherwise see. So if they can see it, they can be it.
All right, Bill, we'll go to you with the same notion.
Okay,
what's
well,
ahead?
I just want to say we were really honored to be even asked by the Federation to join them. We're the only Illinois settlement house, and so, you know, I really appreciate Jessica and Darlene inviting us to be a part of it. You know, where we see in the future as a faith-based organization, we're trying to get more people involved throughout the entire region to recognize the tremendous need and then to become, you know, child advocates and to really, you know, as many great services as we provide, you know, that's extremely important. That's certainly a first step. But we have to look at making sure that a lot of other people in our community are really starting to lift us up and help the kids and volunteer wherever they can. And so that's what we hope to do. And along with building new partnerships, and there's a big thing in the St. Louis region called the Collective Impact that's going on right now. And sometime you'll have to get some people on to talk about that.
Well, in 15 seconds, can you tell me what that is?
It's a effort to try to bring people to similar agencies around a specific agenda, let's say youth violence in the St. Louis region, and try to identify specific ways that we can measure those and bring together what we call a backbone agency to really help us do that. And I think the United Way is going to help the agencies in the greater St. Louis area form these new partnerships and new collaborations that are going to have an even stronger impact than what we have today.
Well, we'll certainly be keeping an eye on that. Thanks for mentioning that, Bill Kreeb, President and CEO of the Leslie Bates Davis Neighborhood House in East St. Louis. Thank you for being with us. Jessica Brandon, I want to thank you so much for being with us. She's Executive Director of the Guardian Angels Settlement Association and President of the St. Louis Federation of Settlement Houses and Neighborhood Centers. And Darlene Soule, President and CEO of Neighborhood Houses. Congratulations on your centennial, and thank you all so much for being with us. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Monday on St. Louis on the, well, I should say we're going to join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, First Things First, for a discussion about Stage's St. Louis production of Legally Blonde, the musical, and our monthly soundbite segment in partnership with Sauce Magazine. This month it's about summer drinks. Monday on this program, we'll demystify the Affordable Care Act, more of many changes in health insurance coverage, also known as Obamacare, set to begin just 3 months from now. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stopublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production and produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer with assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, and Hannah Durham. Executive producer is Robert Peterson. We thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.